Good morning. Welcome to the Commerce Committee meeting on Friday, March 8th. A little navigation for the day. We are going to take up several bills today. Looking at the bills, we are going to try to be out of here by noon or before.
I like that.
And so I'll be watching time closely. I do still think it's a generous amount of time for the bills. And frankly, I have a feeling we might even beat our record. So I just wanted to give folks that heads up so you can plan the rest of your Friday. We are still waiting on a quorum, but we're a half away from a quorum. Representative Katisa Watun, do you want to introduce your guest? I have failed to ask you to do that in the past.
Yep, this is my daughter, Maria.
Welcome, Maria. Once we have our quorum, we will begin. Thank you, honey. Once we have a quorum, we will move this bill officially in front of us and get our minutes heard. But in the meantime, Representative Hewitt, I would welcome you to speak to your bill and allow your testifiers to testify. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe there are some amendments that need to be moved also. So we can't do that yet. Is that correct?
That is correct, Representative Hewitt. But thank you for alerting us to that.
All right. So House File 893 is a great bill. I've never learned so much about accounting in my life. I got to work excitingly with lawyers and accountants together, and that's why it's so thick.
Oh my.
So anyways, it's a great bill, though. It eliminates some fees. It takes care of some retired accountants. It goes after the police themselves, and they're going to bring themselves out of the Pony Express business for mailing. So I'm going to let Mrs. Johnson and Mrs. Jensen tell you about the bill. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here. My name is Doreen Johnson, and I am the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Accountancy. Wow, I love that enthusiastic introduction. I don't usually get that for CPAs. I would like to first hit the meat of the bill, which really addresses retroactive enforcement. Retroactive enforcement would allow us as an agency to take action against a CPA for up to 2 years after the date of their lapse of their licenses. CPAs have an annual renewal of their license, and as you can imagine, we have the ability to take action against a license, so they have to be in a status, active status, in order to go forward and take enforcement action. We've had cases where we are not able to pursue enforcement action because somebody has allowed their license to lapse, and basically this takes it out of them being able to run out the clock. I'll give you an example of the most recent one that we were able to take action on one of the many, and that is in the Stillwater Mail, the Ken Hararicki case. The board was dealing with a case where there was over $2 million worth of fraud, where he had created false tax returns for his clients in order to commit the fraud. His license would have expired on December 31st. As he was facing criminal charges, and we would have lost jurisdiction over him. The board was able to take action on December 30th and have a public enforcement case. Going forward, we want to be able to make sure that we have the adequate time to give due process to all of the parties involved in enforcement action and also to complete the enforcement. So retroactive enforcement would allow us to do that. The Department of Commerce and the Department of Labor and Industry are two large state agencies that already have that authority. The other thing that we would like to add in this bill is a retired status for CPAs. It's an honorific title. Just like many of the medical practices, when someone retires from the practice, they are allowed to use retired and then their designation. And currently, the state law does not allow CPAs to do that. So this would allow them to have an honorific title with some of the standards that are spelled out in the bill. But that's really significant as we are reaching a chronologically gifted age of our CPAs and want that ability to use that title. The thing that applicants are going to like the most is an elimination of a $40 application fee. We used to have paper and pencil fees. That has gone to a computer-based technology, and yet we still are collecting a fee for services that the state agency really is not providing, as we've outsourced that to the National Testing Agency rather than doing it in-house. There's a couple of other housekeeping things, including language on a test. And, Madam Chair, I have my vice chair here, Sharon Jensen, to testify with any additional questions you might have, but that is the crux of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Ms. Jensen, did you have anything to share with the committee right now, or are you going to share technical support? Okay, very good. Well, when we when questions come your way, we'll make sure you introduce yourself for the record. Thank you for being here. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Ms. Johnson.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Oh, my gosh, I forgot. The board has worked extensively with the two societies, the Minnesota CPA, as well as MAPA, Minnesota Association of CPAs. They have supported the bill. We're grateful for that support, and we have worked to do that. And I apologize that I did not give that to the committee at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Is there any discussion from members? Questions for the author? Thank you for the donuts, Representative Hewitt. Seeing no questions, we'll get to our official business. So we do have a quorum. So I will move House File 893 in front of the committee. And Representative, I see that you have two author's amendments. Is that correct?
We do.
Okay. Representative, I will move House File, your amendment, the A19 amendment. It's an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wants. Is there any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, and your amendment is adopted. Is there a second amendment? No. Nope. Sorry.
Okay, I think there was one.
I was jumping ahead. Very good. Thank you. So the motion is to move House File 893 to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation to state government finance. Any further discussion on the bill in front of us as amended? Seeing none, Ms. Jensen, thank you for being here for questions. Ms. Johnson, thanks for your testimony. I will renew my motion that House File 893, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with a recommendation to state government finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails, and you are on your way, sir.
Thanks,
thank you.
Committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Next on the agenda, House File 1840.
I'll vote for you in Ways and Means. We're good.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'd like to move House File 1842, and you will have to help me. I can go to the General Register, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, right. Representative O'Driscoll, that is your
motion. Madam Chair, I move House File 1840 to be re-referred to the General Register after today's committee hearing. Madam Chair, I will just do a quick setup on the bill and give you a little bit of background. In the lending business, there are what we call primary lenders who, I'm going to oversimplify this process, go to their bank vault, if you will, take out money, make a mortgage on that property. Maybe a 15 or a 30-year mortgage. And then what happens is the lender will package that together with other loans and sell it into what's called the secondary mortgage market. Anybody who owns a home has probably received a notice from their lender that says, beginning this day, go ahead and make your payments to us. We bought your loan. And that's a very important feature to be able to have a healthy and sustainable mortgage market in the state of Minnesota and to make housing affordable. To be able to sell those loans from the originators or primary lenders to the secondary mortgage market. In Minnesota statute, we have incorporated in a part of the statute the words subprime. And as soon as I say that, everybody starts getting an opinion about what subprime means, and so does the secondary mortgage market. And that will disadvantage Minnesotans who have originated loans in the state, whose lenders want them to sell those loans or to sell those into the secondary mortgage market. And what this bill does is it cleans up language in Chapter 58.02, Subdivision 27, with references to subprime loans. It keeps every consumer protection that Minnesota has put in place and has been successful. It simply removes the words subprime in references to the definition and words subprime to be able to make these loans more palatable in the secondary mortgage market, since they will be around for 15 to 30 years, so that the borrowers don't experience unnecessary, unintended consequences in being able to sell those loans or to be able to finance real estate in the state of Minnesota. And last year we had some great success working with Minnesota's regulated industries and legal aid, and we thought if 1 year is good, let's make a pattern. So I've got members of the Minnesota Mortgage Association and legal aid both supporting this. They are available for testimony and or questions if the committee has them. They are both listed as testifiers, but I'm not sure if they will. Looks like we do have a Mortgage Banking Association, a representative here today. But, Madam Chair, that is the bill set up. There are no amendments.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Mr. Schweitz, would you like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Sure. My name is Bill Schweitz. I'm here to represent the Minnesota Mortgage Association. And we strongly support this bill. And in addition, I would like to thank Ron Elwood, who's standing behind me, and Legal Aid for helping us craft this bill, because it does continue to protect Minnesota consumers. I also want to thank Representative O'Driscoll for authoring the bill and doing such a great job of explaining such a convoluted technical thing. I really have nothing more to add other than if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Schweitz. Mr. Elwood, would you like to say a few words? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I'll just echo Bill's comments. Thank Bill and thank the author and thank the committee for hearing the bill. And as Beatles once said, I hope we pass the audition.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, member discussion. Any questions for the author or for his testifiers? Seeing none, with that, would you like to renew your motion, sir?
Madam Chair, I renew my motion that House File 1840 be re-referred to the General Register. Members, thank you for your support. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion that 1840 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. Your motion prevails. You're on your way, sir. Thank you very much. That's a record. Congratulations, Representative O'Driscoll. Members, would somebody like to visit the minutes and offer a motion?
So moved.
Representative Mahoney moves the minutes of March 6th. All those in any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Tabke, welcome to the table. You may move your bill as you are on the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm assuming we're moving this to the omnibus bill, correct?
Representative Tabke, it's actually being re-referred to government operations. My
Perfect.
Apologies.
That's what I needed. Thank you. Okay. So I make a motion to re-refer the House File 2018 to, I forget what you said now.
The Committee on Government Operations.
Committee on Government Operations. Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's all right. We're all court low this morning.
Well, and I'm also in a little bit of a panic mode right now because we discovered I'm not 100% sure if I've testified here before yet because I'm a court low this morning. And so Representative O'Driscoll is giving me a hard time about my lack of treats so far, so I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to handle that.
I'm going to say that because Duncan was brought to the committee, who could top that? I think that Representative Hewitt, really
you should have brought the jobs committee yesterday. They had a strawberry pineapple whipped cream cake.
Oh. It's true. All right.
That's amazing.
Well, I'm glad I'm not in jobs.
We have both pills coming
here. I tried to eat all of it because everybody said it was too early.
My pancreas would have exploded. Representative Tabke moves House File 2018 be re-referred to Government Operations. Representative Tabke, I don't see any amendments. Would you like to describe your bill and introduce your testifiers?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill today about from the Minnesota Racing Commission, and this bill is technical changes and different things that need to happen in order to make the Minnesota Racing Commission function successfully and as a continue to be a great commission in the state of Minnesota. So here today we have Mr. Tom DePasquale to walk through the bill for us all.
Welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee, staff, and
Representative Tapke, and for sponsoring the bill. Also with me is Patty Sifferly, the Commission's General Counsel, who's been very involved in the drafting and working with the industry on this bill. So, members, you have three items before you. One is a spreadsheet summary of a section-by-section analysis of the bill. What's notable about that is that three of the sections were in last year's bill that were approved by this committee and this chamber and the Senate and were part of the omnibus bill that got vetoed at the end of session. But sections 1, 3, and 8 were passed last year, and I'm happy to go into detail on any of these sections, but I want to step back and talk about the key elements of the bill, which is in the one-pager that we've provided to you. Just zooming out for a moment, the commission was established by law in the early 1980s, and much has changed since then in the racing industry, most notably in the last 10 years or so. The promulgation and adoption of safety and integrity standards that are uniform. And the difference between racing and other sports is we have no commission, no central authority. We have 38 racing states. So it's up to each state to adopt, stay abreast of those uniform rules and changes and adopt them into statute and rule. So much of what we do in this bill, and the first key element of the bill, is to integrate into the enabling statute the National Uniform Safety and Integrity Initiatives with respect to a couple of things. First is enforcement authority. The thing that the committee page handed to you today is an excerpt from the National Penalty Guidelines that have been adopted in virtually all states, including Minnesota. And those penalty guidelines are prescriptive based on the culpability, the frequency, and the severity of a particular violation. And you'll note that for the most severe types of violations, licensees are subject to up to 5 years suspension, up to $50,000 fine. That was adopted in rule a couple of years ago in Minnesota, but our statute did not keep pace with the rule, so we don't have the authority to impose the type of sanctions for the most serious and unusual, infrequent offenses in the sport. So the statute grants authority so that we're consistent with penalty guidelines. It also clarifies the due process protections for licensees. We have, by rule, very prescriptive due process procedures for hearings, and this statute clarifies when parties are entitled to contested cases, to appeal to the Court of Appeals, and to the Commission. And finally, and most importantly in this area, we're moving the authority for hearings and discipline for the more serious offenses to the people that know the most about racing, and that is the stewards and judges who are the racing officials at each racetrack. We have an anomaly right now in Minnesota that if there's a severe violation, it gets referred to the commission or a judge, a contested case administrative law judge, rather than the officials on the scene. That delays ruling, it stretches things out for a year or two, and we think that those with the most experience should be hearing these things as they happen and imposing appropriate sanctions. The second thing this bill does is it establishes a subset of vendors defined as racing or gaming vendors with fees prescribed by rule. For many years, going back to 1984 actually, license fees for all parties were capped at $100. A couple of years ago, the legislature removed the $100 ceiling. Now we're coming back and saying for a particular category of licensees, that is, vendors of racing and gaming equipment, these people should pay a license fee that more reflects the cost of regulating them, background checks, licensing, and oversight and possible enforcement. Most states, gaming vendors, these are multinational gaming companies, pay tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands in an annual license fee. In Minnesota, they pay $100. So we're looking for authority to impose fees up to $2,500 on a very small set of racing and gaming vendors in Minnesota. Finally, there's technical amendments that actually promote the efficiency and benefit racing in Minnesota, and I'll run through these quickly. One is removal of the bonding requirement for commissioners. Ms. Sifferly has researched, and it appears that MRC is the only licensing and regulatory board in Minnesota that requires its commissioners to be bonded. They don't handle money. They don't conduct audits. There's no reason for the commission to spend money each year on bonding our nine commissioners. Last year, you authorized us to move from an annual report to a biannual report. The reason for that is it's not only burdensome for a small agency to issue an annual report, but more importantly, things are relatively static. And we find that we're repeating ourselves when we issue the annual report, and we think it's better to issue one at the beginning of the biennium for the new legislature. A technical amendment to be more specific about the commission's authority to review annual purse agreements between the horsemen and women and the tracks. Our owners and trainers have urged us to enter into a national racing compact for multi-jurisdictional licensing. Right now, there's 25 states that are members or participants of a national compact that allows a party to be licensed in one state and race in all member states. And the statute change would make it clear that we have authority to do that. Finally, it removes current restrictions on the ability of our racetracks to remove undesirable people from their premises. All private property owned businesses in Minnesota have the right to remove people who create a disturbing environment, and our tracks are no different. The current law requires the tracks to exclude, and then that party has a right to appeal to the commission. We surveyed other states' racing commissions, and we're the only one we can find that places those limitations on their track's ability to remove people from their premises. And finally, there's technical changes to the flow of money through the Breeders' Fund, which have been vetted with our Breeders' Fund advisory committees and are supported by our breeders in Minnesota. So that's a very quick, speedy walk through the statute or the bill that we propose, and we're happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. DePasquale. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, members, are there questions for the testifiers or the bill author? Seeing none, you must have done a very good job of explaining the bill. Representative Tabke, final word.
No, I just thank everyone for the support. This is will directly affect Canterbury Park in my district in Shakopee, and it is a very good bill that fixes issues within the Minnesota Racing Commission, and I appreciate everyone's support.
Thank you, Representative Tabke. Representative O'Neill.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I just wanted to know the path of the bill. I was hearing a lot of different GovOps, public safety, judiciary, something like that, that was changing a lot of different things. I'm just curious where you're sending it.
Representative O'Neill, the motion on the table is to move the bill to the Committee on Government Operations.
Does the bill offer now the path?
Representative O'Neill? Representative Tabke.
I am not sure at this point exactly where it goes after GovOps at this point, but I will find out and I'll let you know.
Representative O'Neill? Okay, thank you. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Tabke renews his motion that House File 2018 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The motion prevails, and you're on your way. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Next up, Representative Schultz, I see, is here. Welcome to the committee. Representative Schultz, while you're getting settled in, I will move that House File 572 be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Policy. I don't see any amendments. Oh, you have an amendment? Okay, my apologies.
Do I have an amendment?
And here's the amendment. My apologies, there is an author's amendment.
Okay, I didn't know this would be writing time, so thank you, staff, working late last night. So the amendment is to put...
I will move the amendment in front of us so we can discuss it. So I will move the A2 amendment to your bill, amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So the A2 amendment... evaluates the medical loss ratio of health plans by the Department of Commerce. This is new language Currently, the Department of Commerce looks at medical loss ratios prospectively, and they evaluate information provided by the health insurance carriers given their forecast of their expenditures. This will look retrospectively and evaluate their medical claim expenses compared to the premium dollars they bring in.
Typically, with author's amendments, we adopt them. I did see this was because this came in late, and because and we don't have rules, so it's not late. It's because this is just in front of the committee. I wanted the committee to be able to hear that. Is there any questions or discussion for the author before we move forward? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails, and your bill, the amendment is adopted to your bill as amended, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The bill restores language to state statute that was removed, I believe, in 2017, and it prohibits our health maintenance organizations from using its net earnings for any purpose other than providing comprehensive health care to their members they cover.
And thank you, Representative Schultz. And we did hear this language as part of another bill earlier this week, so members are familiar with it. I see that Catherine Kmit has signed up to testify on the bill. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kmit. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Kmit to the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And I was here to testify on the bill, but I'm just seeing, this was just put into my hands. The amendment was just put into my hands now. I guess let me just talk about my general comments about this provision. The health plans in Minnesota, the nonprofit health plans, aren't afraid of competition. We're happy to compete with anybody. The problem is we want to be sure that it's a level playing field. And what we were concerned about with the bill as written was that it would give a distinct advantage to for-profit companies who are coming into the market. We didn't have anything to do with the change that was made back in 2017. We didn't ask for that language. We were just as surprised as anyone else when that language came forward. Nevertheless, it was it became law. And so now we just want to be sure if we make any changes that it's always a level playing field and that no one, especially the for-profits, are not given an undue advantage over the local nonprofit health plans. The bill had would have allowed, in our view, would have allowed for-profits to be able to move money around, including to their shareholders, and prohibit the health plans from being able to transfer any assets. If that's the public policy direction that the legislature wants to go into, prohibit transferring of assets, that's fine. Let's just make sure it's a level playing field and it applies evenly. Now, with respect to this amendment, it looks like it's imposing new loss ratio standards, and Minnesota health plans are already subject to loss ratio standards, including at the state level as well as at the federal level under the ACA. Again, I haven't had a chance to look at this. I'm just seeing it for the first time, so I'd have
and
to
Ms.
do
Kmit,
a bigger
if,
dig.
If you'd like, and this might not give you enough time, but we do have another testifier on the bill, and if you'd like,
sure.
If you find anything else in the amendment that you'd like to testify to, we can offer you that time as well, so we have an understanding. I do believe we have one question for you that is relating to the underlying bill, Representative Elkins.
Well, I know.
Or do you want to hold your question?
No, I'd like to ask it now.
Okay, Representative Elkins.
It relates to the amendment as well, but it looks to me like this is consistent with restrictions that are already there and at the federal level and the ACA in terms of the loss ratios.
Representative Elkins, Representative Schultz or Ms. Pump, whoever would like to maybe address where we are currently in statute.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Schultz.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins. So We do have some federal regulations, but there's new rulemaking happening at the federal level, so I wanted to make sure that we're doing an evaluation at the state level as well. Okay. And because of the reinsurance program, I would like to see the medical loss ratios calculated, subtracting out the state payments to the plans through the reinsurance program when they look at their medical loss ratio.
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I agree with you. We always take the author's amendments, and I didn't speak on that. But I'm just going to leave it at this. I'm going to vote against this bill. I think this is a poor way to do business, and I'm just going to put it this way. I'm sure this will get through committee, but I'm going to tell you I'm going to raise Cane on this all the way through the House floor about the process. This is frankly not the way the public should be doing. This is not transparent. I'm disappointed that we would see it this late, not even have a chance to look at it, and it may be a fine bill, maybe a great bill, but this is just not appropriate. And I'm just going to leave it at that, and I will let you know. You will hear more about this as it moves through the process.
Madam Chair, may I respond to that?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when this language, the underlying language to the bill was removed, we weren't even aware of that language being removed. So when your party was in charge, things happened without any notification on the language that was removed. And so we are trying to address that issue of that language being removed and restoring it, and really trying to make sure that we're being fiscally responsible with state taxpayer dollars, mm-hmm. and evaluating where plans and how plans are spending the money.
We do have another testifier from the public, Sarah Greenfield. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Greenfield. I am with O'Connell Consulting, representing Take Action Minnesota. We have 55,000 members across the state in every county and 22 member organizations, and we support House File 572. I'd just like to read the first sentence. All net earnings of a nonprofit health maintenance organization must be devoted to the nonprofit purposes of the health maintenance organization in providing comprehensive health care. After this language in its entirety was removed in January of 2017, within months, Medica, one of the nonprofit health plans in Minnesota, transferred $30,000, I believe, or $30 million. $30,000, we don't count, to Medica of Wisconsin. And MDH testified in a hearing about a month ago that they no longer had the legal basis to reject that transfer. Medica has made two larger transfers since then. Not all would be affected by this language, but the trend is concerning. And in the hearing, that same hearing in HHS last month, you know, I have many notes on how a nonprofit is actually, or a for-profit is actually nonprofit, and Wisconsin is actually Minnesota. I think there would be plenty to discuss even if we restore this language, but the state should have the ability to reject transfers if they are found to be using those dollars gained as a health plan for other than that purpose for which they got nonprofit status. I would just amend that if there is interest in extending somehow this to also cover for-profits, I think that Take Action would be very interested in seeing that, and it seems like likely something we could support, so I'm happy to hear that. But I also want to mention that these transfers have been taking place during the same time period that Medica and many others have been insisting on their need for an infusion of reinsurance dollars to stay afloat, and where HMOs collectively have still found it difficult to produce products that have affordable premiums and affordable deductibles, which has dire consequences for many consumers. So for all these reasons, we hope that we could all agree, and it sounds like there is some agreement, that the state should reserve the right, return to the right, to ensure that these dollars can go, that should go to care, do go to care. So we ask you to support House File 572.
Thank you, Ms. Greenfield. I see Ms. Commit is back, and welcome back to the committee. You can just restate your name and
thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Catherine Commit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I really need to correct a statement by the previous testifier. Reinsurance is not
used to keep the health plans afloat. Reinsurance was put into place to help stabilize the individual market and help to make individual market premiums more affordable for people. You know, health insurance is expensive because health care is expensive. And so much of the discussion at the legislature is about redoing the financing and going after the HMOs and doing all these things, and you guys can do that, but you've got to understand something has to be done about the underlying cost of care. And imposing more reporting requirements and doing all these things, we can do that, but I don't see a lot happening to reduce the cost of care. And until we deal with that, we're really not going to make a big dent. I'm going to have to look more at this amendment because it's not my area of expertise. The health plans have been very transparent about reinsurance. Just so the committee knows and the public knows, not $1 of reinsurance money has been spent, has been paid out yet, because we're still trying to finalize all of the claims that qualify for any reinsurance for 2018, which just ended two months ago. So let's just take a breath and try to address what the real problem is here, which is rising health care costs. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Commit. And this bill does have another stop in HHS policy as well, so we'll be able to continue that conversation. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, members. Oh, sorry, Representative Kreshak.
Madam Chair, did we mention there's another bill out there with some of this language in it? Has that already received a hearing? Did I hear that?
Representative Kreshak, this bill was scheduled to be heard on Wednesday, and because we didn't get to it on Wednesday, we recalendered it for today.
Sure. And I thought I heard, and maybe to the bill author, was there another? Is this language out in another bill?
The language of the underlying bill, it currently exists in a bill that we heard from Representative Liebling on Wednesday and passed out of committee.
Right. So the underlining bill, if I understand, thank you, Madam Chair, is already out there in a current bill, has made deadline. If this amendment would be appropriate, it could go on that. These are just possibilities. I'm just thinking that the process here is getting a little bit quick.
And Representative Kreshak, as you know, in the history of the Commerce Committee is that we have not had a 24-hour rule for amendments. We are an outlier. The 24-hour rule has kind of grown in its scope over the years. The Commerce Committee has continued to not require that 24-hour rule. We do our work quickly and understand that process. If you think we need to revisit the rules of the committee, we can certainly do that. But I have, made the decision at this point to continue the tradition of previous chairs and not exercise the 24-hour rule. But we can certainly revisit that if that is uncomfortable to you. We, as I said, this bill has another stop in HHS policy before it goes to any finance committees.
Madam Chair, I'm in no way questioning your rules. I'm not, and I understand your point, and I'm not trying to make this. Let me back up. We have a gallery of the public. While we have in this committee always done our due diligence and always allowed things to move through, and I believe it's been thoughtful. I also believe a lot of the work has been outside, but I have not seen an amendment show up this late without everybody being involved, and I'm just being honest. Everything you said, the 24-hour rule, your rules are fine. However, I think we can agree in this case, and I'm looking around at the faces of the public, and that some of this is a bit of a surprise, and this may be happening quickly. I've said this before. Convenience for legislature is not transparent for the public. And I'm just raising that out. And you can agree with me. You can think I'm being difficult. And, Madam Chair, if we already have a bill out there that has language and the bill author has decided to drop this amendment, the look on people's face around here was, oh, my gosh, this came fast. Didn't even know the amendment. And if that's what we're going to subscribe to, I just think that's a bad practice. I will do this. You know what? I was going to make a motion to table. I'm going to leave it at that. We'll talk about this later. I'm not questioning the committee. I'm not questioning the way we're doing things. from your perspective, I'm questioning the way the bill author is moving this and getting buy-in, and I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. And I don't think, just to be clear, I don't think for a second that you're questioning the rules and that this is in any way a slam. I think that we should talk about the way we do things and make sure that it does work for the committee. If folks would like, we could look at taking this back up on Monday. We did set aside some time, so I'm happy to do that, and then we could move it to HHS policy at that point. Representative Kreisha.
Yeah, let me offer a compromise.
To
the bill author, if you'll do this, if you're going to go to HHS policy, if you're going to make any more changes that would include the Commerce's purview, what I would ask is that the bill come back to us. Is that fair?
Representative Schultz.
Madam Chair, I just want to make sure we make the, if we can make the committee deadlines, I would be open to that suggestion. But if we, it looks like we cannot make the committee deadlines, then I prefer not to come back to Commerce.
So this, so that I'm clear, Representative Kreisha, you're asking if Representative Schultz's bill is further amended in the HHS Policy Committee and there are additional issues that are brought up that would be under the purview of this committee, you'd like to see it again before it goes to Finance? Representative Kreisha?
Correct. What I would offer is I'll help make the deadlines. I'll even vote for the bill. Let's get it out. Fine with that. Keep your deadlines moving. But if you offer an amendment or you make changes in the other committees that affect the Commerce purview, that it come back. I think that's fair.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. I think that that is fair as well. It sounds like the author is amenable to that as well. So we'll keep our eye on it. And once it is heard in policy, we'll see the shape that it's in and if it needs to come back. Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, different topic, but I just want to underscore something that Ms. Commit had brought forward. And that is, when we talk about health insurance, it's not just one big umbrella. That if you want to think of that, that underneath that umbrella, there's different risk categories and different groups. There might be large employers. There might be consortiums that have gone to the carriers. And all of those fall in what we call the law of large numbers. They actually review those groups and the like. And the idea of the individual market and the reinsurance program, that's for a very specific part of insurance underneath that umbrella. There'll be those individuals who don't fall into an employment group or a consortium or some other kind of permissible association under Minnesota law to be eligible for insurance. And those are the ones who are really getting a difficult time finding insurance. And so the reinsurance program is targeted specifically at that group of individuals, small employers perhaps, as well as people who can't find insurance from other areas because of employment or other personal circumstances. So I just want to make sure that we're on the record understanding that the term health insurance is not a one-size-fits-all type of description on that. Madam Chair, I know you are carrying the reinsurance bill and have to be a co-author with you on that because we definitely need to look at that market. So I wanted to go on the record with that since in a previous testifier's testimony, it was all these dollars are going into reinsurance. I want to make sure that people understand that that is a very targeted market that we're looking at for a very vulnerable group of people in the state of Minnesota whose premiums are skyrocketing as we're sitting here today, too. So enough on that, Madam Chair, but just wanted to make sure that I underscored that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Is there further discussion from members? Seeing none, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 572, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The motion prevails, and you're on your way.
Thank you, Representative Madam Chair, Schultz. Members of the committee.
Representative Mahoney. Welcome to the committee, Representative Mahoney. You can move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 1241. I think it's going to labor.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's going to labor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1241 is the Minnesota Call Center Act. Page one, pretty much just definitions of business entities and call centers. Section three actually starts actually starts getting into what the bill is doing, which is trying to get a notification from a call center if it is moving at least 30% of its calls to overseas, out of the country. Section 4, page 3, this is really a clawback system for places where we in the Jobs Committee push a lot of money out into other parts of the state and to get these particular facilities to locate in the Twin City, in the state of Minnesota. It also, in Section 5, I think it is, I think Section 5 is the one where it says you don't get to use these people again for a good length of time. I don't know exactly how long it is. Bothered to find that one out. Section 6 helps get people retrained. That's what it does.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Do you have anybody testifying on your bill today?
I have Brad Leto.
Welcome to the committee, Representative words. Leto. Or Ms. Keep trying to get people elected. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commerce Committee members. Good morning. My name is Brad Leto, Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota AFL-CIO. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 1241. I'm also here on behalf of the thousands of Minnesota Communication Workers of America. CWA is working to pass this bill this session, and has worked on it in similar bills in the past. Unfortunately, a number of the people that were going to testify had to be at a national conference today. Call centers are an important economic lifeline for many communities in our state and across the country. With 57,000 plus call center workers, union and non-union, employed in the industry in our state. Thousands of call center workers across the country have lost their jobs in recent years as major corporations have offshored customer service operations. The trend has harmed working families and communities in Minnesota and across America, while endangering consumer security in some cases. For example, call centers in Costa Rica that were moved there were home to a massive telemarketing scam that defrauded thousands of U.S. citizens, most over the age of 55, of upwards of $20 million. The process, with new tax provisions in the federal tax bill, companies are even more likely to move the customer service jobs overseas, something overlooked. According to the Joint Committee on Taxation, the new territorial tax system exempts offshore income from U.S. taxation, estimated at $250 billion over the next decade. We should not be creating any tax incentives for corporations to move the jobs. We need to put the efforts that Minnesota needs to put the efforts of workers first, add new levers of accountability, and ensure our taxpayers' dollars are not rewarding companies who are actively eliminating good jobs in the state. Good jobs for workers, men and women, people of color, and those who represent almost every ethnic group in the state. And if you doubt that, we'd be happy to have you tour a call center to know that. As Representative Mahoney said, we believe this is important because it grants, loans, tax benefits, and state contracts for companies that shift customer service jobs out of the state and allows the state to claw back the outstanding value of any taxpayer money or benefits the company received, the provision that's been in bills in the past. A call center employer that intends to relocate at least 30% of the call volume in the year out of state is required to notify the state. House File 1241 provides legislators a great opportunity to do something tangible to demonstrate support for Minnesota workers. Please vote yes to move this legislation forward to the Labor Committee. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we can move to member discussion. Members, any questions for the author or the testifier? Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of maybe a question to either staff or to Representative Mahoney, but I'm looking at line 2.26 through 2.29, D, kind of talking about the semi-annual list, and it appears that we're asking the commissioner to compile data from around the country and not necessarily the state of Minnesota. And I'm just wondering if that's what we're doing. So we're supposed to kind of reach into other states and seeing what's going on, or, I mean, compile a semi-analyst with all employees that relocated to a call center or one that had units within a call center comprising at least 30% of call center operation from the United States. Am I reading that right, or should we, I mean, Minnesota?
Well, we are the all-powerful state of Minnesota, so I think we should be able to do that. But if we can't, I'm going to ask the commissioner to make sure that he or she can give me a stronger answer. That's what it looks like. That's what I'm going to try to do. I am more concerned primarily about
Minnesota. Yeah.
And any call centers that do that, and try to keep track of the information of call centers that do something like that around the country. Certainly, I don't know I don't have the complete procedure, and the commissioner hasn't, and I haven't talked about that particular section.
Madam Chair, is the commissioner here at all? I mean, the commissioner's office here at all? No.
Is there anybody from the commissioner's office that is in the audience?
I did not invite one or call anyone or ask them to be here for this particular.
Representative Skulczynski.
Just from kind of that standpoint, I mean, is there kind of a fiscal impact from that workload, or, I mean, I don't know if I saw.
Representative Skulczynski, we're not a finance committee.
I know,
but labor, just, but yeah. I think it's a legit question. We'll let the author answer, and if he doesn't have an answer here, we'll have it in his committee.
Okay.
Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, Representative Skulczynski, I have not asked for a fiscal note because I did not expect that, and I was not told kind of an off-the-cuff, kind of, no, that shouldn't be a problem.
Okay.
But I will check into it more, and it will give us something to talk about in energy.
Sounds good. I don't know if that's going to be there. And then just on line two. Thank you, Madam Chair. Line 2.1 to 2.5, kind of that employer means business enterprise employees. Is kind of from a Minnesota stamp, do we need to define Minnesota in that portion, like that they're based here, or because it doesn't, you know, because if you combo that and that, does the commissioner have to track some of those things between those two lines of law? We might have a little confusion in there of what the role is and where those jobs are actually located and that sort of thing. So.
Yes. Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, Representative Skulczynski, I was not made aware of that when we had this go by some of the office people, but I will check a second time to make sure before we see it in labor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Skulczynski. Additional comments, questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 1241 be re-referred to the Committee on Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and you're on your way. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Stevenson. Welcome, Representative Stevenson. You may move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 1424 be re-referred to Ways and Means. Oh.
Representative Stevenson, I believe that it needs to be seen in Higher Ed, Finance and Policy first.
Yeah, I thought that they're part of Ways and Means. I thought, I'm sorry.
Through Ways
I misspoke
and
spoke
the. Got it. So, to be clear,
with Ways and Means.
The motion is House File 1424 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with a recommendation for a referral to Higher Ed, Finance, and Policy.
So moved.
Boom. And I see you have an amendment. Would you like to move your author's amendment?
I would move the A1 amendment. This is an author's amendment that primarily derives from my hatred for the word ombudsman.
Thank you, Representative Tabke. Representative Tabke moves the A1 author's amendment. Is there? I mean, Steve.
It does sound like something Tabke would do. But.
Thank you for helping me keep y'all straight. I appreciate that. Okay, Representative Stevenson moves the A1 amendment, author's amendment. Is there any discussion to that author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. The motion prevails, the amendment is adopted, and the bill is in the shape the author desires. Representative Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think it will not be a galloping shock to anyone in the room that Minnesota is in the midst of a student loan crisis. Levels of student debt in Minnesota are among the highest in the country. We consistently rank in the top 10 for student debt. Minnesota has 775,000 student loan borrowers carrying $27.1 billion in student debt. Even worse, the crisis is escalating. Student debt increased between 2007 to 2017 by 127%. This is also an issue that affects the entire state. In fact, 51% of millennials who live in greater Minnesota are carrying student debt. And it's a struggle that people are constantly dealing with. It impacts every corner of people's lives. People are putting off decisions about whether to start a family or buy a home. It limits their job options, the amount of student debt that people are carrying. And part of the big problem we have is the monstrous amount of bureaucracy and regulations and rules that apply to our student loans. The many student loan servicers across the country that have different practices, some of which are very abusive. There's no one who's just on the side of the student lender or borrower, the person who's taking out the loans. And this bill attempts to fix that by creating someone in the Department of Commerce to act on behalf of people who are trying to navigate our student loan system and put some guardrails onto our student loan system here in Minnesota. And to kind of put a fine point on how this could be useful, I want to tell you a little bit about my own personal situation, because I am a student borrower. I still have student debt, and so does my wife. And, you know, I've mentioned to this committee before that I'm a prosecutor for Hennepin County, but before that, I worked for many years at a large law firm. And I moved from the large law firm to the prosecutor's office because I wanted to engage in public service. I wanted to be doing good in the world. But when I did that, I took a 60% pay cut. And, you know, I've got small kids and, you know, family to support. And so that was not without risk. But one of the things I took comfort in was the existence of a federal program called the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, which a lot of people who make the same choice that I make rely on. And that's a program that says that if you work in public service for 10 years, the federal government will forgive your outstanding loan balance. Now, that program's relatively new. It only came into being in 2007, which means that the very first people who were eligible to participate in the program and get their loans forgiven made those applications in 2017. And when they did, we were pretty disturbed by the outcome of what happened. In 2018, the Department of Education, the federal Department of Education, released information showing that of the 29,000 forgiveness applications that had been processed, 98% were rejected. And they were rejected, 28% of the rejections had to do with filing errors, clerical mistakes. And 70% had to deal with not meeting program requirements. And as we dug more into that, it's turned out that a lot of people were under misapprehension about what loan programs were eligible to be in the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. So they were toiling away for years after years, making payments, thinking they were making progress towards this Public Service Loan Forgiveness, only to discover after 10 years that they were in the wrong program. If they had just been in a different program that whole time, they would have gotten forgiveness. So we need someone that will be an advocate for those borrowers, who can explain to them where they need to be to get the benefits that they're working for, and not just for people involved in public service. I mean, anyone who's a student loan, who's a borrower, needs to have someone who's on their side. The bill also has to create some educational opportunities around the area of student loans, because there's just a lack of information, a lack of confusion. I don't know if anyone else was listening to NPR this morning as they were coming in, but I heard a story that was really timely about the closing of Argosy's campuses across the country, and actually, Madam Chair, in Eagan. Today, they're closing down. And NPR had a number of people on, a number of students on, expressing great concern about what their future was, particularly as to their massive amount of loans that they had out. Would they ever be able to get the benefit of what they had signed up for? We need to have someone, an expert, in our state government to help those students move forward. Minnesota's entire business model, our competitive edge, is our highly educated workforce. And student loans is how the overwhelming majority of people pay for higher education. So this is critical to the future of Minnesota's economy. I do have a number of people I understand who want to testify on this issue, and I'd happily yield to them at this point.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. There are a number of people who signed up to testify. Verlina Bradley is first on the list, followed by Molly Geislinger. And you're welcome to pull up another chair if you'd like.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Committee. You may state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Verlina Bradley. I'm a first grade teacher at St. Paul Public Schools. I have worked in education most of my life, and the teaching career is my first love. I have found such gratification in serving students and families from my own town, community, and pursuing my dream job has crippled my finances. Education loan debt is out of control and burdening students and working families across the country. I know because I'm one of 44.7 million Americans with educational debt in Minnesota alone. People owe $25.5 billion, and that's 68% of Minnesotans carry student loan debt. I'm on a 10-year payment plan for loans I can't afford, and I'm living paycheck to paycheck due to my wages being garnished. If that's not stressful enough, I have to deal with the unaccountable and abusive loan officers who by day just change up and hang up their calls, and I can't get through. And when I try to call them to get my questions answered, I'm on hold for 30 minutes to 50 minutes at a time. I'm talked down to by the so-called customer service representatives, and I don't get my issues resolved. I've been misled into taking out student loans with high interest rates with little to no information on the term of the loan. Then I find out companies were selling my loans to each other, so then I have a difficult time figuring out who I owe. My wages were ultimately garnished with no notifications, no letters, and they told me that this is just how it's happened and to deal with it. A student loan advocate would definitely help and protect people like me who just want to live the American dream and not have so much hardened debt. Let's make sure those who are taking out student loans get the right information to make the best decisions to limit their debt load. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony and sharing your story.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Hollison, members of the committee. My name is Molly Geislinger, and I'm a 42-year-old educator who taught positions in Minneapolis, Wayzata, and for the last 16 years in Bloomington. Throughout my years of experience, I've been lucky enough to work my entire career with middle school students, first in the classroom as a language arts teacher, then in different Bloomington schools as a peer coach, and currently as the dean of students at Olson Middle School. However, I'm not here to tell you how much I love my job. I'm here to talk about the $90,000 in student loans that I've accumulated over the 18 years and that will continue to grow for the next 18 years with no idea of how I will pay it off. When I graduated high school in 1994, I was ecstatic to find out that I was accepted to the University of North Dakota. I would be the first person in my family to attend a four-year college. My mom and I shared many sleepless nights as we tried to navigate the tedious and complex financial aid process. This was before the days of online applications, so we would wait months to receive information in the mail, only to find that we had forgotten one thing and then having to start all over. With only 1 month to go before starting my freshman year, I finally found out that I would get a Pell Grant, work study, and financial aid to help me through the first year. This would continue for the next 5 years I earned my teaching degree. Still, even with the financial help and working every day of my college life to pay for living expenses, I was $45,000 in debt. Flash forward 8 years, newly married with a baby on the way, I would go back to school for a master's in differentiated instruction from Concordia University. This would help me grow as an educator to serve my students, move me up the teaching ladder, and help my family financially. Again, I would need financial aid to assist with this degree. Once again, flash forward 8 years, I enrolled in Mankato State to obtain my administration license. I graduated in May of 2016 with 3 degrees and $90,000 of debt. I've been told, apply for teacher loan forgiveness. Sure, but unfortunately the process is so complex and only works the right person who teaches the right subject or in the right school or is born during a certain period. I'm asked, do I have financial hardship? Yes, I just told you I have $90,000 of debt. My monthly payment is $900 a month. We do not live outside our means. In fact, we moved 49 miles from where I work so we could find a home we could afford and allow my mom to live with us to save on daycare costs and help with the mortgage. I have done everything right. I've worked hard. I've graduated from high school and became a first-generation college graduate. I continue to grow in my career, and I'm at the top of my pay scale in my district, and it's not enough. I'm not alone in my story, and many student loan borrowers see their debt load increase because of abusive loan servicers and lenders. Creating a student loan advocate within the state government would be a first step to lower education debt and protect those taking out student loans from misinformation, customer service failures, and discriminatory practices. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you again for telling us your story. Next on the list, Bonnie Latrell. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bonnie Latrell, and I am the Director of Research at the Student Borrower Protection Center. Prior to this role, I served for 5 years at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, where I worked in the only unit in the federal government solely focused on protecting student loan borrowers from predatory actors in the financial sector. I am here today to tell you that hundreds of thousands of families across Minnesota are depending on this bill. Like the borrower in Duluth whose servicer prevented her from making payments for 5 years while her co-signer was in bankruptcy and saw her balance grow by $23,000 as a result. Or the borrower whose servicer repeatedly ignored his payment instructions. Because the borrower couldn't pay down extra principal like he had planned, he paid thousands of dollars in needless interest. Or the borrower from Minneapolis whose servicer didn't process her income-driven repayment plan application on time, and as a result, her interest capitalized and an unaffordable payment came due. This is the real story of the student debt crisis. Millions of borrowers' lives and livelihoods are being crushed in the gears of a broken student loan system. And at the center of it all are student loan servicers, some of the largest financial services companies in America. These are out-of-state companies that will determine the financial future of hundreds of thousands of borrowers in the state, including more than 170,000 borrowers across rural Minnesota. But it has become abundantly clear that this industry is failing, and in the process, cheating the very borrowers they are being paid to serve. Across this country, the student loan servicing industry has failed every type of borrower with every type of loan at every stage of repayment, from the day a student receives her first bill until the day she pays off her last loan. We see student loan servicers cheat borrowers in financial distress, denying millions of the most vulnerable borrowers critical protections against financial ruin and saddling them with billions of dollars in additional debt. I came to St. Paul today to make one simple point. There is no white knight. The federal government is not going to ride to the rescue. There is no cavalry on the horizon. Tens of millions of student loan borrowers are falling victim to a federal government that is not only walking away from this fight, but is aggressively arming the other side. But fortunately for student loan borrowers, the state of Minnesota has the power to stand up for its citizens. And that is where this committee comes in. For too long, student loan companies have been allowed to operate in the shadows, unchecked. But this committee can change that by giving the state of Minnesota new tools to stop abuses by these companies. This legislation is critical to ensure that state officials have the authority and the legal tools necessary to stand up for hundreds of thousands of Minnesota borrowers. This bill puts in place the critical oversight that the federal government is failing to provide. So I'd just like to close with this. Student loan borrowers need your help. They need you to intervene in order to protect an entire generation squeezed by mounting debt. This committee can send a clear message to those borrowers who have done everything we have asked of them, taking on historic debt to earn a degree to chase the American dream. They need to know that their struggles matter, that their fight is your fight. They need to know that Minnesota will not sit idly by while they are cheated.
They need to know that this committee and that this state will stand up to protect student loan borrowers. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, members, discussion, questions? Seeing none. Final word, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a good first step in trying to deal with a crisis that's facing Minnesota, and I ask for your vote.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. With that, Representative Stevenson renews his motion that House File 1424 be re-referred to Ways and Means with a recommendation for a re-referral to the Committee on Higher Education, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, and you're on your way, Representative Stevenson. Members, impressive work today thus far. Thank you, everybody. Representative Fisher. This is the last bill on our agenda today. Welcome to the committee, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I will move that House File 1138 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. I don't see any author's amendments.
That is correct at this point. There's been a lot of discussion, but we haven't come to final language yet on some of them.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. To your bill, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to, for you to take up House File 1138. It's the Digital Fair Repair Bill Act. The purpose of this legislation is fourfold. It's to give consumers the choice, especially in greater Minnesota, of where to bring their electronic products and when they will require repair, to support and grow small business and jobs, to guarantee free market access, and just as importantly, to help reduce the growing amount of e-waste that is harming our environment. This is getting to be a bigger problem as more and more countries are refusing to take our e-waste. We want to make sure that we're being more responsible of what we're generating. House File 1138 requires original equipment manufacturers, known as OEMs, to make available instructions, parts, and tools to independent repair businesses and or consumers to fix the electronic equipment. Trade secrets are not to be divulged, and data privacy is protected in this bill. Some industries have been exempted in this bill. Otherwise, this is very similar to the bill that was done in Massachusetts. Bottom line, Madam Chair, members, is if you can choose where to get your car fixed, you should be able to choose where to get your phone or anything else that's electronic that fixed, with all the necessary information available. Madam Chair, to give you a little bit more perspective on the bill, I have a number of testifiers here with me, and I would like to start inviting them down at this point in time. Do we already have a motion for moving this bill forward and re-referring?
We do, Representative.
Okay, super.
So a number of members of the public have signed up to testify this morning. If it's all right with you, I can go through the list.
Please, I would appreciate that.
Lucy Lloyd, welcome to the committee. Could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lucy Lloyd. I am the owner of Uptown Tech, a small, rural, independent repair shop specializing in Apple devices based out of Glenwood, Minnesota, which is a little over 2 hours northwest of here, and population 2,500. I first got started in repair 6 years ago and self-taught and independent, like I said, and the need arose in the community, and working at my former job, I was in a K-12 technology support job, and we had devices that needed repair, and I took the initiative and drive to learn how to repair those on my own and really served a big need for the school, and then that grew to the community as well for personal devices and phones, and I since have expanded to just a personal business. And I feel that my drive and self-initiative is very reflective of the rural communities. We want to be able to be self-sufficient, we want to be able to fix our own things, and we love to give back to our community and the people that we know and is in our community. And then not to mention the fact that if we didn't have this, we would have to drive, like I said, 2 hours to come to the cities in order to have our phone repaired or have to mail it in for however many weeks that takes. So just being able to have someone locally saves time and money and energy to be able to have it repaired quickly. And the other factor, too, is that in my position, Apple is limiting for the authorized service providers and the time and money that goes into that as well, that the process to do that is substantial. And so being able to just repair on my own and just serves a big need for the community. So thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, Amanda LaGrange, followed by Madeline Ciosi. I'll try that one. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amanda LaGrange, and I have the honor of being the CEO of Tech Dump and Tech Discounts. Today I'm here in support of HF 1138. TechDump is a Twin Cities-based organization. We have 60 employees. We were founded in 2011. And since that time, we've processed over 25 million pounds of electronics. And that may sound like a lot, but it's really just a very small percentage of what we see here in the Twin Cities. What's special about our organization is, in addition to our environmental focus, we also are working to employ individuals with various barriers to employment. A high majority of the organization is employing individuals that have had a history of incarceration. They're in recovery from addiction and have some challenge that they're working through our training program. And so we've seen firsthand the amazing job creator that repair can be. We estimate that only about 15% of the weight that comes into our organization can be repaired currently, based on the amount of parts and manuals available for purchase, and yet within our organization, it creates about 50% of the jobs. If you were to come and tour our facility, you might feel like you were seeing a scene from Frankenstein, because to refurbish a laptop, our team is harvesting parts from other laptops. So maybe if you have a broken laptop screen and it comes in for recycling, we're finding a matching model to go find that screen to replace, which you can imagine how difficult that is. It's not scalable. If you think about having a broken windshield on your vehicle and you take it to the dealership and their answer is, well, let's just wait and see if we get another vehicle just like this one that we can remove the windshield from to fix yours, that is the equivalent of what my team does every day. So you can imagine, not scalable and definitely cost prohibitive. It's really hard to source these repair parts, and it's very labor heavy, which makes this lack of repair parts and manuals a big challenge for us to be able to grow. And it's why it can be really expensive to buy secondhand. We have a brand of Tech Discounts, which sells quality refurbished electronics. We stand behind our materials with a one-year warranty on our products. And that $100 laptop that now an individual can afford in our retail store maybe allows a youth to learn how to code. Maybe it allows the person doing a job search to be able to apply for that next opportunity, or maybe a small business owner to have the technology that they need. But these electronic devices truly are available for quality use if we could just access the parts and manuals for purchase. So thank you for your time. We ask for your support.
Thank you for your testimony. Yeah, it was really interesting to learn about your business, so I appreciate that. Madeline Sissoni and Tina Patton, followed by Tamara Gillard. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tina Patton. I work at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Madeline Chochi is in the office in the audience today in case I can't answer some of your questions. I'm here to testify on behalf of the MPCA in the support of the Digital Fair Repair Act, House File 1138. We believe implementation of this bill has a net positive environmental impact, and it would also increase jobs and economic activity in Minnesota. Reusing and repairing is considerably more environmentally preferable even than recycling, not only because you reduce the waste going to landfills, but more importantly, there are fewer resources required to reuse and repair than to recycle. It's the second of the three R's: reduce, reuse, then recycle. And when you look at the resources required over the life of electronic equipment, that's from raw material extraction to processing that material to manufacturing and assembly, transportation use and disposal, many resources are saved simply by extending the life of a product.
For example, an 8-ounce phone requires over 165 pounds of raw materials to manufacture. Also, 70% of the energy that a laptop consumes in its lifetime is used in the manufacturing of that laptop. The Pollution Control Agency also supports this bill because it will increase good electronics repair jobs in Minnesota. In 2011, the PCA did an analysis of job and economic impacts of the reuse industry in Minnesota, and it showed that over 28,000 jobs were in repair. And reuse, rental, repair, and recycling together with associated downstream jobs represent $26 billion in sales. Almost half of the state's repair jobs are outside of the Twin Cities metropolitan area. The PCA also administers the state's e-waste program, and so we know that electronics are still piling up. Currently, we've estimated only about 1% of household electronics collected under Minnesota e-waste law are repaired and resold now. More could be repaired if they had access to repair manuals, parts, and tools. So to sum up, eliminating barriers to repair and reuse will improve environmental and economic outcomes, which is why the MPCA supports this bill. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll continue with public testimony, and then if we have questions for you, can we call you back up? Thank you very much. Tamara Gillard? And Bruce Miller would be following. Ms. Gillard. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Tamara Gillard. I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Computers for Schools. MCFS is a nonprofit organization now in its 22nd year that works with schools and educational organizations to provide technology solutions and skills training to individuals in need. Our program began in a partnership with Stillwater Correctional Facility. However, due to the tragic death of Officer Gom in July and the subsequent changes in Stillwater made to their industry programs, MCFS has relocated to Minneapolis. MCF recycles, refurbishes, and repairs donated computer technology, which is placed in schools and nonprofits across the state of Minnesota. Since our founding in 1997, we have placed close to 90,000 computers in the community. In addition to providing access, we also provide free IT certification training for individuals, most from underrepresented populations who are preparing for entry-level employment in the IT field. In the fall of 2018, we began offering our IT graduates paid internships to gain hands-on skills working with computer equipment, better preparing them for the workforce. I am here today in support of House File 1138. It is critical for us to have the right and ability to repair computer equipment. This provides low-cost technology solutions for our schools, whose budgets are already strapped. The ability to repair also provides much-needed work training experience, preparing individuals for jobs in our community. In your packet with my testimony, I've offered testimonials from three of our educators and a couple of our students just for you to be able to see the impact this technology makes in our community. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, for telling us about your program. Bruce Miller. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Bruce Miller. I am with Minnesota Farmers Union. Thank you to the committee. Thank you, Representative Fisher, for presenting House File 1138. 1138, as you've been hearing from everyone, is a measure that gives consumers, including farmers and repair shops in local communities, access to the tools, parts, and repairs that they need to keep things working. It would cover most devices with embedded software, anything from smartphones to software-driven farm equipment. Minnesota farmers have relied on their handiness and ingenuity for decades, only now to be told that they or their local repair person are not allowed to fix the ag equipment or other tech-based tools that farmers own without voiding their warranties just because those machines rely on software. We need to address and change that, and this legislation begins that process. I think this is going to be a longer discussion. I think it's going to be an issue that we need to continue to deal with. I just want to share an unsolicited email that I just got from one of our farmer members, John North of Jackson County, who sent me an email since he knew I was coming. People follow me on social media that I don't even know follow me. But this, he wanted me to bring this to the committee, and I ask your indulgence to read this. Dear Legislative Committee, I have experienced several problems with modern farm tractors. The main problem does lay with the fact that the technology that is required with computer and sensor systems requires a reader for the software and the ability to detect the problem. Today's farm tractors are capable to cover many acres in an hour. The unit I'm involved with is a 32-acre per hour tractor, and in the springtime, when the rush season on, where time is extremely important and valuable. Unfortunately, any problem, which usually stops the unit, requires a call to the dealership and a service call. The last problem we had with the tractor, it would drop RPMs to a point that the horsepower required is not usable. So I called the dealer, waited a couple of hours. The technician arrives, plugs in the computer, takes another hour to isolate the problem. The decelerator pedal used to drop the RPM for headland turning had a dead spot in the sensor. The technician called the dealer, not available as they sold the last one, 1/2 hour before the technician called the dealership. Meantime, the clock is ticking at 32 acres per hour. The planter units are catching us in the field work. Two planters, two operators, one support person, fertilizer, corn, fuel, and any common parts needed. The technician tells me that if we could find a way to isolate the pedal of the tractor in a top position, the unit would run properly. Then we could use the throttle lever to drop the speed for turning. I went into my shop, bandsawed a 2x6 wedge, installed it against the footrest, and duct taped it to the pedal. The unit ran perfectly, finished the season with the improvised solution. As operators, we need to be able to find the problem, call it in, locate parts, and fix it. Today's tractors, planters, combines are extremely dependent on electronics, and the systems are subject to any variation of any type of current drop, corrosion, vibration, high moisture, dust, dirt, so it is vitally important to be able to diagnose the problem. I have experienced sudden stoppage once crossing crossways on a major highway, Highway 71, with a 40-foot folded disc. Sudden stoppage while tilling soil is also not enjoyable, to say the least. Thank you to the committee from Mr. North. I just want to clarify that we're asking for farmers to be able to help find help quicker. A right to repair does not equate with an ability to repair, but increasingly we have technicians who are available who can do this that are not a part of a dealership. We have the sons and daughters and grandchildren of farmers who are attending great educational institutions and are learning this. When I grew up in central Minnesota, just not far from Glenwood, Minnesota, actually, it was 7 miles to the repair shop. We could make a parts run. As a matter of fact, sometimes made many parts runs. That's not the life in rural Minnesota now. And we, you know, combines and tractors and equipment doesn't know whether it's Democrat or it's Republican. Heck, they don't even necessarily know if they're red or green. But what we do need to do is have the ability to continue to use the ingenuity of farmers and family farmers to help explore this. And we're willing to work with the committee and the legislature and the author to continue this discussion. I think it's complicated. But we have all the respect in the world for the dealerships and the technicians. We just need to be able to learn how to do some of this work ourselves. And Madam Chair, Ms. Fisher, thank you. Committee, thank you. And any questions you have, I'd be happy to answer. And I'm going on a phone call in a little bit, and Mr. North is going to be on there, and I can tell him that I have shared his message with the committee. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. You can thank Mr. North for his testimony as well. A few more. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, people who have signed up to testify. Tony Quillis, followed by Lisa McCabe. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning,
state your
Madam
name
Chair.
And proceed.
I'm going to bring Ms. McCabe down with me
good.
So we can move you along, because I know it's been a long week, a long day, and along with those regards, you never want to be the last speaker before happy hour.
And we can pull a chair up there, Ms. McCabe.
Before happy hour? Before. It's only
10 o'clock. Well, no. When you're in a convention, Representative Mahoney, you never want to be the speaker, last speaker between lunch and happy hour. So
appreciate
I know that it's been
everybody.
A long week, and this is the last
indeed.
Bill. So I have a 45-minute PowerPoint presentation. Madam Chair, thank you for the time today. My name is Tony Quillis, for the record, and I represent a couple of folks today in front of you, the Consumer Technology Association and CompTIA, which is the Computing Technology Industry Association. And as Mr. Miller touched on, it is a complex issue before you today. I just wanted to touch on a couple of things before I turn it over to Ms. McCabe, who's going to touch on a couple of the security and privacy issues. When we talk about, we've discussed briefly today a talk about farm implements. We also talked about phones. But under the definition of the bill on 2.1 to 2.3, when we talk about digital electronic equipment, it talks about any product that's functioning in whole or part with digital electronics embedded in the product. So think about that. We're talking phones, computers, printers, microwaves, washers, dryers, toys, ATMs, ATVs, farm equipment, snowmobiles. So I just wanted you to know the scope of what we're talking about here when we talk about providing this information. Second of all, you've heard consumers have choices right now, Madam Chair, whether it's through the original equipment manufacturer, depending on the product, mail-in programs, certified, authorized, repair dealers are available, and also retailers, usually where you purchase the product, also provide programs that you can go through and fix. But the key here is always the goals are to ensure quality, safety, and security of the product, because it leads me to my next point is the folks I represent have spent millions, if not billions of dollars, establishing reliable and reputable brand products. And so when we go through, safety and quality are of the utmost importance. So when we go through, Madam Chair, we're concerned about when we're providing documentation, manuals, diagrams, reporting, outputs, that proprietary information is included in there. And so that is a large concern to the folks that I represent. I know Representative Fisher referenced that there was a trade secret in there, protection in there. But if you look, it says, you shall not divulge a trade secret except as necessary to provide documentation, parts, and tools. And when you go back to that definition of documentation, it's pretty far-reaching. So I'd like to point that out to the committee, Madam Chair. Just fair and reasonable terms is another one that is concerning to us. Ms. McCabe's view of fair and reasonable terms is different than my view of fair and reasonable terms, which I'm sure is different than your view of fair and reasonable terms. So I wanted to point that out to committee. I'll let Ms. McCabe touch on some of the data privacy issues that we have concern. And one last point, Madam Chair, that I'd like to make is no other state has passed a bill regarding this. Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. McCabe.
Ms. McCabe, welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today. My name is Lisa McCabe, and I'm with CTIA, which is the Trade Association for the Wireless Communications Industry. And our members include wireless service providers, infrastructure providers, suppliers, and manufacturers. And we are concerned that this legislation does have unintended consequences for the operation and security of electronic products. I think it's also important to note that this bill provides no quality assurance protection for consumers. As was already mentioned, consumers, manufacturers rely heavily on their brands and spend a lot of money to guarantee that, to provide that throughout the life of the product. And one of the ways they do that is through authorized repair. Authorized repair is assures proper repair and safe repair, because these authorized repairers are trained to know how to work the product, how to safely repair the product. This bill reduces consumers' protections by creating a greater chance for unsafe repair. It also harms the marketplace by weakening the relationship that manufacturers have with authorized repair networks. It also discriminates. It discriminates against a set of firms to the detriment of others. It places the state at risk of running afoul of federal law. For example, there are a number of legal conflicts that are presented in this far-reaching bill because it could touch up against interstate commerce protections provided by the Constitution. This bill compels manufacturers to engage in specific economic activity with specific firms, particularly without any contract, any statutory or regulatory protections, and places an undue regulatory burden on manufacturers. This bill also has the potential to harm and weaken the cybersecurity of devices and potentially the security of the information on those devices as well as the networks themselves. I think it's also important to note that when a user no longer wants an electronic device, it has value. It has value in the marketplace. It can be sold. It can be traded in for another device. And in many cases, we see a lot of people give it to a family member. I know that's what I did with my old phone, gave it to my daughter. Manufacturers and wireless service providers offer consumers many opportunities. They can donate their device as well. Many service providers have relationships with a number of nonprofits that need phones, and they can use that to support those organizations. The market already provides a wide range of options for consumers, many of whom spoke today. So we don't need a state-mandated bill to do this. The marketplace is meeting consumer demand. And as was stated, 18 other states have looked at this issue and have not passed bills, have not moved forward on this. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the sign-up sheet is Neil Ville, followed by Tim Schaefer. Sure. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Neil Ville. I am CEO of World Data Products. We're an independent refurbisher, repair service provider, and a reseller of information technology equipment, primarily computer servers and networking gear originally manufactured by companies such as Cisco, Dell, HP, and IBM. We employ 55 people in Plymouth, Minnesota. We've been in business since 1987. We save customers approximately 50% or more versus the price of new equipment. Our customers are typically the small to mid-sized businesses that do not have the clout to be granted large discounts by the manufacturers. The highest and best use of a piece of used technology equipment is to keep it in use, and we keep these products in use and out of landfills. We take great care in terms of data security. Our standard practice is to wipe and all the hard drives that come in, any data that's on a memory stick, on a piece of firmware, on a hard disk or other storage device such as tape media, is thoroughly eradicated before these items are resold. In terms of jobs, I'm also a board member of an international trade association called ASCDI that has many members in the state of Minnesota. ASCDI has a database that says that there are 122 companies in this state, in this part of the business, the independent technology refurbisher for those higher-end equipment pieces that are in corporations, and estimates that in the state of Minnesota that just in our sector alone, we employ over 3,000 people in these jobs. We believe that for Minnesota companies to be successful and growing, to maintain and increase jobs in Minnesota, that we support the Digital Fair Repair Bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Tim Schaefer, followed by Kyle Ode-Paul. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, members of the committee. Just want to note that Kyle Opdahl couldn't join us today, so I'll be the final testifier, other than any of the folks from the public. So I want to thank you for giving me the chance to speak today in support of House File 1138, Right to Repair. I'm Tim Schaefer. I'm the State Director of Environment Minnesota. Our interest in this has a lot to do with reducing e-waste. We've studied some EPA data from 2010 and found that 6,500 cell phones are thrown away every day in Minnesota, which is a extremely avoidable phenomenon, as the folks from the PCA pointed out earlier. But I also would like to talk about this as an issue of fairness and of access to the economy for folks in greater Minnesota. As Lucy pointed out earlier, there are a lot of regions of the state that don't have substantial repair services available. And there's only a limited number of authorized service repair places. Last time we checked, in fact, I went back to listen to the testimony from last year, there are 64 authorized repair service providers for smartphones in the state. And you can imagine, given the many millions of people who live here, that doesn't really meet the needs of consumers. So this is about reducing e-waste, but it's also about making parts available to folks like Lucy who want to be able to provide competitive services with the original manufacturers. So, yeah, I just want to keep things short, but I will also point out we've had a good amount of time to talk about this. We're happy to talk to folks who have concerns and work out some of the details with the language, but we think that this is a really important piece of policy for the state. And it is, as Representative Fisher pointed out, a extension of the principle that applies to cars, that you should be able to fix your car where you want, you should be able to fix your cell phone where you want. This has been passed related to cars in Massachusetts, so this is not new stuff here. And, yeah, happy to answer any questions you might have and also to bring folks back to answer questions you might have as well.
Thank you for your testimony. Terry Michalecki is on the list. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Terry Michalecki. I'm a shareholder. Michalecki.
Thank you, sir.
You're not the first one. I'm a shareholder in a John Deere dealership. We're called SEMA Equipment. We have 8 stores in southeast Minnesota and 170 employees. I'd just like to state that I oppose this legislation. As with any bill, there's probably a lot of good things in this legislation, but the devil's always in the details. And specifically, I'd like to start with how parts are addressed. Kind of reinforce what I heard here before. It says parts will be supplied at a fair and reasonable price. My question is, fair and reasonable to whom? Does that mean I, as a John Deere dealer, am required to give sell parts to my competition at a price they request? Or does that mean John Deere as a company is required to give parts to my competitors at a price they request? And if that is the case, wouldn't that make de facto John Deere dealerships of pretty much anybody who wants to be get those parts? With all due respect, I don't think it's the government's place to tell us who I can sell my parts to and at what price. I believe free enterprise will resolve that issue. I have a whole business based on selling parts to customers. And yes, I do sell to the competition because it's good business. The next thing I'd like to address is how much information the customers have. The gentleman that was up here before said his customer couldn't get the information he needed. I'd ask him to call my dealership. I can get him that information. There's a tool called Customer Service Advisor that John Deere dealerships have. It is akin to Service Advisor, which is what our dealer technicians are given to use to diagnose problems on our tractors. They can get the same information from Customer Service Advisor as they can our dealer technician tools. They can have the technical manuals. They can have the electrical schematics. They can have the hydraulic schematics, anything you need, with the exception of embedded software. And that's the devil in the details on this bill. You see, what we have right now is a situation where if this bill is passed, customers will be able to easily bypass emissions controls on their tractors. I find it ironic through this process that one of the supporters of this bill is Environment Minnesota, and they have good rights to support this bill. But if you look at it, this bill will actually cause more pollution to the environment. You see, when a farmer gets access to the coding of how their tractor is run through the engine control units, one of the things that they will do, and we know they're doing this because right now they're doing it illegally, is they will bypass the emission controls, the exhaust gas recirculation systems, and the diesel particulate filters. This will cause more pollution from the farm segment. I believe several people have pointed out that this is passed in Massachusetts. I guess I can't speak to that, but I know that there's 33 other states where this similar bills like this have not passed. So, again, there's probably some good intentions with this legislation, but the devil's in the details. I don't believe the government should tell us who we can sell our parts to and at what price. And this bill will cause more air pollution from farm machinery if passed. So I would ask you to vote no on this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes the list of testifiers who have signed up from the public. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Mr. Patrick. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Bobby Patrick, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for Medical Alley Association. Medical Alley Association has over 600 members, including many medical device companies of all sizes. And we just want to start by thanking Representative Fisher for working with us on this legislation. It does contain language exempting medical devices. But the language that is currently in the bill is imprecise and could cause risk to patient safety. Medical devices are subject to significant regulation from the federal government, from design to installation and repair. Repair services need to be certified by the FDA in order to repair these devices, and the device manufacturers are responsible to the FDA for any errors or repair challenges that are caused by these third-party servicers. So just in sum, I won't take much time. We just want to thank Representative Fisher. We've been working with him on language to fix the impreciseness, and we'll continue to do so. So thank you. Now I'm ready for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Patrick. Is there anybody else from the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill?
Question for the
afternoon. Oh, for Mr. Patrick?
Yes.
If you could say, Mr. Representative Mahoney, thank you for clarifying. Representative, or Mr. Patrick.
Representative Mahoney, whenever you're ready.
seeing no one else from the public who is wishing to testify on this bill, member discussion. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill author, I understand your desire, Representative Fisher, to expand options for people, but have you taken into consideration the manufacturer of the product? For example, and I won't use any brand names, I'll just say the Acme phone. All right, Acme spends an awful lot of time promoting, servicing, building brand on their particular devices. And so when they ask to have their device serviced by their approved providers, they're preserving the goodwill and standing of their product in the marketplace. And I would suspect that if someone went to a non-certified provider, let's say, and they had had difficulty with their phone, that may be the consumer going, well, you know, the Acme cell phone, it's just a real problem. I've had nothing but difficulty with it. But had it been serviced by someone who had gone through the screening, the training that the company or the manufacturer of that particular item does, then it may not have been a problem, and they could have preserved their goodwill and their name in the marketplace. How does your bill address those kinds of concerns that people who are the providers of these products?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Driscoll, for the question. What this reminds me a lot is back when I was growing up, it was very easy to get your equipment fixed, any of your electronics. You just went down to your local repair store that was around the corner because parts were readily available, manuals were readily available, so that people could be able to get their items repaired. These days, if you want to get a TV repaired, it's very difficult to find anybody who's got access to the equipment to be able to do so. And as a result, if you're able to find them, many times the price to get the part repaired is more than the TV itself. And so this is what's adding to the e-commerce that is, or the e-waste that is occurring out there. And as a result, what has happened is a lot of people who used to do this work are not as readily available. In instances where you've got qualified people who are out there to do it, it's not unusual for your computer. If you've got your computer and you've got a problem with it and you want to get it repaired, you have to box it up, send it away, and it'll be a couple of weeks before you get it back. Now, if you're a small business relying on that computer, you're not a business for that couple of week period. That's unacceptable. The problem is we've narrowed the process so much that the availability for repair services are not out there on most products when you need to have them. Adding to e-waste, adding to problems with businesses sometimes getting things done, or just individuals who are trying to get their homework done on a computer that fails, or a cell phone screen. You know, even with the cell phone screen, if you want to be able to get your cell phone screen addressed, is the process is so complicated. If you want to go over to Apple, sometimes you've got to wait a long time. Depending where you live, if you live in the wrong part of town and you rely on buses and the authorized people are not on a bus line, you no longer have the opportunity to get your cell phone fixed without spending hours and hours of trying to find a way to bike over or walk over to where the utility is. What has happened is, as a society, our repair, we're at a point these days where we're no longer focused on repair, we're focused on disposal. We need to reverse that and make sure it's easier to bring that repair system back into process, because right now it's too narrowed and too focused on people being able to sell new products instead of reusing old.
Representative O'Driscoll, follow-up.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Fisher, again, the question I asked was, what safeguards are there that are in the bill to preserve the goodwill of the manufacturer, the producer of the product, if it goes to a third party? Again, I didn't hear that in your statement, and I'll just put another tag onto that, and perhaps you can address that again. And then this question, when someone goes to purchase a product as a part of their due diligence, not, you know, let's just take it out of the Acme cell phone as I was talking about, any kind of a product. That, I think, today is a question that people would ask. Where is it serviced? Where, you know, how would I get this repaired? Does an individual own any responsibility in their due diligence of knowing, well, how that process would work to be able to get that device repaired or to receive service on that in their decision-making process? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Seems how I get to be the chair now.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Yep. No. I'm going to ask the question for Representative O'Driscoll. Is there a need to have the goodwill? I mean, I'm frustrated with the particular piece of equipment. I can't get it repaired at the authorized dealership. Why do I need to have the goodwill of the manufacturer? I need the product to work. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to get to the premise of your question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I asked the question of the bill author, but I'll take your question before that. As the provider of that, you probably also have, or someone who provides services, you probably also have your preferences of who you'd like to do business with or where you may purchase things, and you do that based on a package, not just one individual item that that particular product or that particular company does. So you look at that in totality and you say, gosh, I want to go on, I want to buy, or I want to do. There are people in my district who say, I'm only a Ford person, I'm only a Chevy person, because they have built goodwill and customer loyalty with that organization because they like the package of what they're able to get from that organization. So if the testifier could answer my, or the bill author could answer my question, I'd
certainly
like to have that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. I'll use the analogy of right now is when I get my car fixed right now. I've got a Honda. So what I do is when I take my Honda to get fixed, I go to the local repair store, who's not a Honda dealership, but is the local small business, Venberg Tire. Does a great job. They not only take care of tires, but other repairs. I take it in there. That has no impact on how it damages the regular brand that we have out there. When I go into a repair shop, I don't see it impacting, and I don't see this bill having any impact that would harm or cause harm to a brand dealership. Because as with the car, when you go in, I know that when I'm not going to a Honda dealership, I'm going to my local person, that they're the ones that are taking care of making the repairs on it, and that it's not the company Honda brand that is doing the work in the process, and it is not harming the Honda brand, but it's taking care of other parts that are being repaired in the process. The other thing that comes into it is when you take a look at some of these products that are out there, Representative Driscoll, you were saying, well, when we buy our products, we know what we're getting for repair services. That has been my biggest problem when buying electronics, is because every time I buy it, I know if something goes wrong, I'm taking a risk because I'm going to be out of that product for a number of weeks, because it's not like it used to be. I can't go somewhere local to get it done. Many of these places are centralizing their repair parts in different parts of the country, and you ship it off in those kind of situations. And as a result, that is one of the problems and one of the things that a lot of consumers have when they take a look at some of these brands out there, that they don't have the proper, appropriate follow-up services. And that is some of the things that I've seen in some Consumer Report publications, where not all companies do as great of a job as others. There are some companies that do a great job out there. Unfortunately, we have a number that don't. And I think the bill protects the good companies out there because they're making sure those things are available for repairs out there. But that's not everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Elkins, did you have a
Madam Chair. Now we're back to Madam Chair. I'm sorry.
We're keeping you on your toes there, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to speak to this myself. I have a personal experience. So my previous cell phone, the battery was dying, so I called the manufacturer and was told, sure, ship it to us. We'll get it back to you in 2 weeks, and it's going to cost you $150. Well, I couldn't do that, so I took it over to a little place in Richfield where they did it for half the price while I waited. So I understood that I was taking a risk that the manufacturer might be voiding my warranty, but the situation was such that if I couldn't get this battery replaced, I was just going to be throwing it away anyway, so the risk was very low. A few weeks ago, the magnetron on my microwave oven went out, so I called the manufacturer. They referred to me one of their authorized service centers in the Twin Cities, who sent somebody out after 3 days, who promptly told me that, oh, you should just buy a new one instead. I didn't take his advice, and I had the magnetron replaced for about $100 versus spending $400 or $500 for a comparable replacement equipment. But people ought to have the choice to be able to make the kinds of decisions that I made to go to alternate locations to have service done and done well.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have found this conversation to be just really, really interesting. I just love the can-do attitude that this bill brings behind it. Just having this ability to where people want to fix things, I think, is just fantastic. And this is a good Minnesota bill. I think there's clearly some work that needs to be done, but it has benefits for the environment, benefits for farm country, small businesses, consumers. When you buy something, it's yours. To Representative Elkins' point, you may no longer have that warranty coverage, but there are benefits to trying to fix things yourself and extending the life of a product. So I think just in terms of some of the comments that were raised in terms of the goodwill that a company would have around those concerns. So clearly this is a conversation that struck a chord with Americans across the country. Of 38 states are already having this conversation, and I'm surprised that Minnesota is a little late to the game on this. This is very Minnesotan in terms of the demographic of our state, and both kind of a way in which to unite both greater Minnesota and the metro area. So Representative Fisher, this is something that I want to offer help in working with. I think this is something that with the right can-do kind of attitude, we can come up with something and maybe be a leader in establishing kind of a gold standard with this. So I applaud your efforts in working on this, and again, offer whatever support or help I can offer to keep this moving. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Fisher, for bringing this up. The purpose of it, when you start talking about the can-do attitude, or that I understand the sentiment about. However, what I have heard here is all of those you can do now before this law goes into place. Representative Elkins could do everything he wanted to do, and there was no law in place that said you could do that. So it seems to me there are situations that we're hypothesizing that may not actually exist. I have a couple questions that I have, and I see the gentleman from Farmers Union left, and so to the bill author, I heard the combine incident, and I understand that. Harvest time, I grew up, been a farmer, been that. I've been in many situations where you could be last minute to get things done. However, I also heard he bandsawed a piece of wood to fix a piece of machinery that can do bodily harm to other people. My concern is here, you start getting into that, and I've been in those situations, are they overriding safety protocols that could hurt somebody? And then if that person gets hurt or severely injured, who's responsible? Because your bill has now allowed those changes to happen.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Kreisha, for the question. This is one of the things that we've been working on as we're going forward here is in the situation you're just mentioning is you could see that change that was made right there. In other words, it was one that probably violated some of the safety protocols that one would say was out there. It's something that the person had to do, though, to be able to get their crops in. That is one of the things that sometimes happens. After it was done, he was able to take it off and repair his tractor to where it needs to be so it could work again. We want to make sure that we're protecting that aspect of it. I know that the example I would use is in the medical device area. You know, we've had discussions on that because we want to protect that safety process. But we also want to make sure that as we are addressing those, that it doesn't become over-encompassing where people will start encroaching in other areas to the point where we get back to the situation where we have right now where when things need to be repaired, you don't always, in some areas you can find people that will repair it, but because of limits on others, you can't. And it has a lot of barriers in the process. And so what we're doing is I'm willing to continue working on this. I know that the safety concern is there. I've not had the people from the farm implements come talk to me yet. We've had the bill out there for a number of weeks, and I've just heard from people in the last couple of days. I'm committed to keep on working on this because safety is always a very important concern. I do know I've had some other companies that have talked to me about where we've got lease instances, and some of those make common sense. And those are things that we're also looking at drafting language. But once again, those discussions with me did not start approaching me until within the last 24 to 48 hours. So what I'm saying here is I'm willing to continue to work on to make sure that we get these done, but so that we can continue the consumer availability and the repair things that we need to have going forward. Mm-hmm. Because we all like to have that great safety that we've had over time, but we also want to make sure that we're reducing the e-waste and everything else that goes with it.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. And the next stop for this bill is judiciary. So that will be a good place to work on these issues around civil liability. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Fisher. I'm glad you're committed to working on this because I'm not going to ask you to yield all these questions. I'm just going to throw up some scenarios. If you want to take notes, these are things that I would bring up as we come later. So first of all, I understand the environmental concerns. I don't know that this bill gets there. There's other ways to get to the recycling. That seems to be more of a cultural throwaway society that we have. Frankly, it's a market thing. We can lower the price by making products that are easily disposable. So I'm not sure we can get there by legislating that, but I understand it. The other thing is, here's a couple scenarios that I bring out. So you have a local person that has created an app for a phone, and does this give that person, does this give people the ability to change the source code on that, on the firmware? And now that product is handed to somebody else who doesn't know there's been changes to the source code, but there's damage, say, to their accounting files or damage to their, and causes brand damage. Are they going to sue all the way back to the main company? Because you're not going to know where that source change was. That's a problem. The other thing is you start doing hacks like this, and these are hacks. You get them on the Internet, and our friends across the pond in China don't care. And now these things are opened up, and they're out there. Those are all concerns that we should look at. The last thing that I would put, injury is very important to me. I mean, I've been on a farm, and I could see, I've run those combines where your sensors are now disabled because you're trying to get that harvest done and you've killed your son. Or you have a worker that is maimed. I mean, you know, we're sitting here today about to vote on something that could allow somebody to make a decision on their combine and allow them to get source code to hurt somebody. We need to be very careful about that. And Representative Fisher, I know you're talking about that, but boy, I would hate to be in this committee as we're now bringing a bill back trying to figure out how do we unlegislate something that is causing that kind of harm. And the last thing is I would just say is you have a lot of work to do on this. I think you're trying to legislate out Murphy's Law, and I don't think that's going to be a very easy task. So I wish you well, and I wish you luck. I can't support it here. I would actually hope that you would keep it here and keep working on it because it sounds like that's what you want to do. But, you know, good luck and keep moving on forward.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. I saw Representative Fisher taking copious notes. So I hope it sounds like he's taking your advice to continue to work on it. Any brief follow-up, Representative Fisher, or are you just going to work on it?
No, I just want to say thank you for the continued input on it. I appreciate it. It's something that we will keep addressing as we go forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Fisher. I, too, have noticed that you've been taking a lot of notes, and that's very encouraging, and I know that you'll do a good job with the bill. I'm glad that it is going to judiciary, but I'm just going to – my testimony or my questions have changed a lot listening to everybody else, so this is kind of like just my comment section. There are a lot of recycling programs already out there for electronics. There's a wonderful facility in Monticello in Representative O'Neill's district. I've had the opportunity to tour that. It's amazing what they do with electronics and recycling. Best Buy also has a recycling program where you can take some parts in for nothing and some parts you have to pay for. So those programs are already out there, and we actually take advantage of them a lot. Having rental property, people leave things behind, we do that a lot. And I really appreciate the fact that they're doing that. When it comes to automobiles, and such, I take my Mustang to Joe's for the ordinary stuff. But when it comes to the recall notices I'm getting for the parts, I have to go to 1040. And I am very comfortable in doing that because they are the ones that manufactured that piece. And I think that's an important part that I don't want to see changed because right now it has to do with an airbag. And I will tell you that most people with Mustang convertibles probably store them in Minnesota in the winter, and I get something just about every week reminding me to do that. And I'm afraid that if we do something different, those safeguards would probably go away. I also have a couple friends who have a piece of equipment that helps the turkey industry greatly. They spend a lot of their time checking to see what China's doing, because China's always trying to knock off a lot of the stuff that they're doing. And to have some of their trade secrets out there, that is very concerning. They spend a lot of money protecting their product, and they should. It took them a long time to be able to perfect that, to work as best as it can. So the very fact that we're going to allow some of their information to get out is very, very concerning for me. And as I would imagine it is for John Deere, too. I know a gentleman who, actually my family, when I grew up, had an implement dealership in Watkins, not right down the road from Mies John Deere. And we saw a lot of the tractor things going on, but it has changed so much in the time that I have seen it, where now Dan, who I know, drives tractor, and then drives is kind of a precarious term because he basically just sits in the tractor while the tractor drives itself. That's how far they've advanced. And now farmers are going to school to figure out how to use all this technology and how they do business. Now, if you allow that to be given to somebody else, not only am I worried that the product won't work as great, but what happens to the who's liable for all the things that could happen and may happen because they don't have the expertise the way a John Deere dealership would have that expertise, because that is what they do. A lot of times when I buy a product, I look at where it's coming from and how do I get it fixed. I built computers for several years, and that was wonderful. But you're really looking at using products from Intel and a whole plethora of other folks. We put them together. We took care of it, and yes, we did have parts on hand because things do malfunction, but I think that's part of the business. And when I look at where do I go when I buy pieces, computers are very important to me. I make sure that I am able to get that done because I'm not very nice when my computer doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And if I'm only home for the weekend and it doesn't work, yeah. I'm not a nice person to deal with. So I make sure that I have products where I know I can go. But if the screen on my phone breaks, I know that I can go to batteries plus bulbs and get it done quite quickly. I think there are a lot of safeguards in our communities now, our businesses now. I know that they're seeing that it needs to be out there. So I appreciate the intent, but I'm really scared about what it could mean. And for those reasons, and I know, like I've noticed you've been taking notes, so I think judiciary is a good place for it to go, but I would really like to see a lot of changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. That Mustang is really cool, and I'm ready to see springtime so we can see it back in the garage.
We'll be out of section.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of a question on, I got a couple, but from an authorized repair provider to an authorized repair provider. So is this bill only focused on from an authorized repair provider to an independent repair provider, or could this equate to an authorized repair provider to an authorized repair provider? So let's say you're driving a John Deere tractor, and let's say I live in Nassau, Minnesota, which is a quarter mile from the South Dakota border that has a New Holland dealership, and they're close, but they don't have anything. I don't want to pay for shipping to haul it to Wilmer to go to a Kibble or wherever that might be, or Bonavideo. But I can have that dealer request the tool or the parts to fix it. Does that, or is it only independents?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What we want to do is make it so that it works for everybody. So in the situation that you mentioned, their authorized dealer, is I know that in some authorized dealers, they're able to do it for more than one brand and be able to fix things back and forth. But some brands may say, well, I don't want to work with authorized dealer, I'll work with this person instead. What we want to do is make it so that your authorized dealer can be multiple across the board. So in your situation, I would think you want to make sure that the authorized dealer you're going to could also do the other work, say, you know, the say like John Deere versus another farm implement. If the one is closed or something happens isn't there, you want to have the option, maybe if the other one is able to do it, is to have the opportunity to go over there and get it done so that you can keep up and running. So it would not just be the independents, but also making sure that you've got more authorized dealers out there, you know, making sure that someone's company doesn't say, well, if you're only doing Apple, we're only going to have you do Apple, you won't be able to do anything else. And that would get that some of that type of thing out there. That sometimes happens is some brands say, if you're doing our brand, we don't allow you to do any others. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a problem.
All right.
Fellow President, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just kind of some of the other questions that I'm wondering about. On line 3.33, it talks a little bit about original equipment manufacturer can make available a part that is no longer available, so that essentially gives them an out. What if they're manufacturing parts? So in the instance where Representative Atke, they actually make the part, but they don't actually sell the part. So let's say you have a manufacturer in China that's developing a piece of software equipment or a TV where the part is actually made, but they don't actually make it available for sale as an individual part. So it's not an idea that something's just not being repaired. Would you force those manufacturers and that dealer to make available a part that's not for sale? I mean, because you address manufacturer of, but not necessarily sale for sale of.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a very good question. I haven't had that type of question proposed to me before. I would say that, you know, if you've got the parts that are being made out there right now, somehow that should be available to make sure that you can do repairs. I would think that if a company is producing and I'll use the example of snowblowers or lawnmowers. If they're producing those kind of, you know, they're continuing producing the same model and that part is available, all of a sudden, if that part breaks and all of a sudden you can't use your lawnmower anymore, even though it's being made and you're being told you can't buy it, you know, the company doesn't have to sell it to you, now aren't you in a situation where you have to throw that equipment away and now you have to get a new piece of equipment? Doesn't feel right, and that's one of the things that we're trying to get at in here. And I think that is addressed in this type of situation, but it's one that we can take a closer look at. I think it's important that we make sure if the parts are still being produced that they're being made available. I know, and we already do this in the auto industry. We require auto industries to make sure that they carry the parts and make them available for 10 years after the model year is done. So I think because we've already done those kind of things out there, we should be able to do that in other areas.
Sir, Madam Chair.
Representative Swazinski.
Representative, you know, you kind of brought up to the kind of force manufacturers. You know, electronics is a bit different, you know, just from a technology standpoint. Let's say we're talking about windmills or solar panels or digital devices. Is your plan to eventually, you know, force parts availability to say if you're going to produce a phone or if you're going to produce a toaster that you would have on stock and parts available for that to keep those products from going into the waste stream?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not saying that they would have to continue producing them, but if they're making the part right now or the tool that would be used for repair, that they have to make it available to people to, so they continue repairing the products out there.
Representative Swazinski.
Madam Chair, so essentially, so let's say you're selling computer equipment and you have Windows Model 10 as a software component. Do you feel like that's kind of important that you would uphold, you know, support services, the tool? I mean, is that kind of the direction too, or?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we're talking about parts, if they're no longer producing the parts or they're no longer providing services, they've made a conscious decision that we're no longer producing that item. They're no longer producing that item. This bill would not force them to continue providing support in those kind of areas. What we're looking at is just making sure that the tools and the parts are available, the technical manuals, the guides, so that the work that can be done as long as they're out there. We're not saying through here that we're going to force that you've got to carry it for X amount of years, et cetera.
Representative Swazinski.
Madam Chair, you know, I think, you know, I appreciate the fellow from, I believe Mr. Miller from Farmers Union. You know, one of the ideas is we talk about tools. Sometimes we think about, you know, screwdrivers or wrenches. You know, one of the thoughts that I had is if you're a dealer and oftentimes mechanics own the tool, not necessarily the equipment provider or the person, how will that relationship work?
Representative Fisher, and then we're going to, if I assume that we're pretty close to
we're
wrapping
getting close,
up.
Maybe like two or three more.
Representative Fisher, I think one more.
I was going to negotiate with him. Last time he tried to go for 6 months. I just said no more.
I can call it.
I mean, it's kind of ironic that we're talking about farming equipment as that plow has gone into the ground so far.
I have,
oh, man.
Madam Chair, I have no.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. I've lost parts of the question here, so if I'm missing it, please let me know. I'm sorry. Now I've completely.
I'll just repeat it.
Thank you.
So,
Representative Swazinski.
So essentially, you know, when you're dealing with repair shops, right? You know, so certain tools are owned by the dealer, and certain tools are owned by the individual within the shop. So, I'm making the point of a diagnostic tool that, you know, essentially during a harvest season, you know, if you're required as a dealer to provide a diagnostic tool, which may cost $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 and potentially has the ability to be proprietary to a John Deere or a Case or what might be, if you're forced by law to provide it during the most busiest time of year, because you don't own two, you own one, this is not talking about a screwdriver or a wrench, you know, will that dealer then fall under, you know, state law and potentially be, hey, we're not going to provide you that tool and have liability?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's nice about this bill is this is not dealing with dealers. It's dealing with the original manufacturers and the companies that make them. So it'll be up to the companies that make them themselves to figure out how they're going to do that. That would not be so up to the dealers. The dealers would still have their capability to do what they want to do right now. It would be up to the manufacturers to determine how they're going to provide that to the other independents.
Representative Swazinski, one final question or comment.
Yes, Madam Chair. My comment would be I'm very concerned just, you know, we talked about a can-do. I don't think we should be a standalone state. I believe there's 38 other states that are contemplating or at least having a discussion about this type of legislation, but certainly no other states have passed it. I believe this issue should be dealt at the national level, and I don't believe that this should move forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. And my intention is to bring this to a vote in the next 5 minutes. Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to say real quick, Representative Fisher, thank you for working on this. I very much agree with the intent and the direction you're going with the bill. I think it's critically necessary for our future. But as you and I have spoken about, just want to get on the record the fact that I have significant concerns about where we draw that line as to what needs to be proprietary and ability for manufacturers to lock down how repairs can be done on work. So thank you very much for your work on this bill and continuing to work for it on it.
Thank you, Representative Tabke. Seeing no further member discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 1138 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no.
No.
No. The motion prevails, and you're on your way to Judiciary. Members, just for our, this was the, concludes our agenda. I do want you to know, because we concluded our agenda, there will be no meeting tomorrow. There will be no meeting Monday. Way to go, Commerce. And with that, we are adjourned, members. Thank you. Enjoy your weekend. It's 5 o'clock somewhere.